This is a Defocus Media production.
You only get one chance at a first impression. And for new contact lens wearers, that can be the difference between success or dropping out of lens wear altogether. Today's world is fast-paced and highly digital. In fact, young, new contact lens wearers average over 9 hours per day in front of screens. And during those hours, they are blinking 60% less often, which leads to more dryness and more eye fatigue. The Acuvue Oasys one-day contact lens design meets today's digital demands. In a recent clinical trial of daily disposable contact lens wearers who use digital devices 8 or more hours a day, Acuvue Oasys One Day was superior in comfort and reducing the symptoms of dryness versus other daily disposable contact lenses. When you make that initial lens selection for your patient, prescribe a lens that will set your patient up for success. We only get one chance to wow our patients by having them love their contact lenses from the very first fit. You can learn more about the Acuvue Oasys One Day family of products at acuvue.com.
Hey everybody, I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session. Welcome everybody back to the podcast. Thank you again for joining us. And I am delighted to have a special guest on, Dr. Nate Radcliffe. And before I go into all of the accolades that Dr. Radcliffe has, Nate, would you just mind just giving us a brief review of who you are and where you've come to be in ophthalmology?
My pleasure. And Chris, it's great to be here. And I love listening to your radio voice. And now I see it fits perfectly with your podcast. But something just clicked there. Nate Radcliffe, I am a New York City ophthalmologist. I did most of my training in the city, except for my internship in Hawaii, which is an important part of me. I am a glaucoma specialist, and maybe I've gone a little overboard in terms of wrapping my life around glaucoma. I've been in academics in and out, NYU, Cornell. I started my career, Mount Sinai currently, but I'm also in private practice and in the Bronx and Queens treating some pretty heavy duty glaucoma out there. Like you, I have a passion for educating my colleagues. I work with a glaucoma physician. I'm the medical editor of that magazine. I also work with iWorld as a glaucoma section editor. And really just passionate about this kind of peer-to-peer education with an eye towards glaucoma. But I love cataract surgery, dry eye, and all the good stuff that comes with taking care of eyeballs.
So where were you leading us when you mentioned Hawaii?
My internship was in Hawaii, so that was the best year of my career. That's where I peaked.
That's where you peaked? Yeah. Great.
How can you do better? Although I am happy to say that I'll be directing part of the glaucoma section of the Hawaiian Eye meeting moving forward. Wow. So I do get to go back at least once a year now.
Huge deal. Yeah. So, before we dive into a topic, we are, knock on wood, hopefully seeing a light at the end of the tunnel with COVID. Although, quite frankly, COVID is probably going to be something that stays with us in perpetuity, on and off. But, being in New York City, with masses of people and really masses of high percentages, particularly early on, how was it for you during 2020 and then early 2021 and where we are today?
Yeah, I mean, that early period was scary for sure. And, we shut down, completely because we really had to. Amazingly, my one comment that I'll make is that, I've actually really seen the city suffer and change and grow and shrink and just kind of go through it all. There's something where the city is sort of showing you all the things that everyone's going through on the inside. And, New York City has been empty at periods of time. It's now very crowded again. We're all kind of hopping on subway cars and seeing them be full and not even know what to make of that. Sure. So, that's been kind of the alarming, scary thing for me, is to just watch a city suffer like that. I don't think it's the same. I don't know if it'll be the same soon or ever, but it's really, I think it's just the whole point is we should all just give ourselves a break and recognize we've all been through something totally traumatic with this pandemic. And, you know, no one gets through really truly unscathed, you know, on the inside or the outside, I don't think.
Yeah, no doubt. There's going to be some lingering effects, both, you know, subtle and then real, that are going to be with us, you know, for the rest of our lifetimes.
Yeah.
All right. So the topic for this podcast is Allergan was approved by the FDA to launch Vuity, the first drug for presbyopia, back in October, came to the shelves mid-December, and now we are in March, you know, still at the infancy of this, and you and I have been able to take part in pre-launch activities for some time now. You know, does this still excite you to the extent that it has, you know, leading up to the approval?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I would argue that as with any new therapy, you know, as much as you believe in it and, you know, want to bring it to your patients, your brain isn't always just ready to start using it from day one, because you've been an eye doctor now for many years and you've got a new tool, but you're still kind of in the habit of using your old tools. And so just today, you know, I found myself recommending Vuity to a few patients where I think even a month ago, I might have let them slip by without thinking of it. So that's the excitement for me, is that, you know, you find the place where it fits in your practice every day and you grow into a new treatment option.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that. You know, rarely in our professional lifetimes, in any profession, do we have the opportunity to, number one, talk about something that's first ever in a treatment or a class or a procedure. But then secondarily, for a lot of us, it's something that I know I didn't ever predict it was going to come. And so, if you know, at least in my career, it's kind of the first one of those. I mean, I know that LASIK came about and that was the first of its kind. However, you know, RK had been around, and I remember seeing some international TV shows, even in the 70s, of some, you know, surgical treatments that were approaching. So I guess it was always in my brain, but despite having used pilocarpine before for glaucoma, I never ever thought that somebody was going to reformulate, optimize this for presbyopia. I mean, did it surprise you too?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've sort of considered myself a long-term pilocarpine prescriber. I was trained by the great Robert Rich in New York City, who, he wrote an article, you know, 20, 30 years ago called The Pilocarpine Paradox. We were talking about pilocarpine all throughout fellowship, prescribing it quite a bit. So I knew the drug and I knew about its benefits. And I would have patients comment all the time about how they had some reading improvements. Mm-hmm. But it takes a lot to get it from what I was looking at in fellowship, which was a QID drug that made the eyes fairly red, to what we have with Vuity. And I think that's the nice thing is, you know, when a pharmaceutical company with a good experience in formulations, they've done it with reformulating Lumigan, reformulating Alphagan twice, Allergan just kind of knows how to make the special sauce, adjust the pH, work with preservatives, work with excipients. And it's kind of cool to see them take something that hasn't had the best profile in the past, but has a great profile now.
Yeah, no, yeah, agreed. So let's talk about your experience with pilocarpine. I know in the years that I prescribed it, the most common percentages I would think about were typically 4% and 2%. And, you know, generally speaking, 4% tended to be my darker skin patients, darker irides patients, and then 2%. The opposite of that. But this is the four times a day medication. So it is a leap and bound beyond concentration and beyond the dosing.
Yep.
Of that is Vuity, 1.25% daily. So, you know, what types of side effects and things do you recall during your pilo days for glaucoma that you may or may not be thinking about when implementing Vuity?
Yeah, you know, this is great because, you know, on the one hand, part of what I want to say is Vuity is a totally different pilo than what we had in the glaucoma world. And on the other hand, I also want to say, I don't believe all the side effects that are out there for even for traditional pilocarpine. So let me, maybe I'll hit that first.
Okay, perfect.
You know, pilocarpine is rumored to be quite a villain. And, you know, the things that, it's been accused of causing are retinal detachment. It's been accused of causing peripheral anterior synechiae. You'll even hear people say it causes cell and flare. And, you know, these are things that I want to just take them one at a time. And we'll start with the retinal detachment. You know, there's a handful of case reports in the literature about patients who happen to be on pilocarpine who had retinal detachment. You know, and I tend to think that, look, pilocarpine can constrict the pupil, can move the iris lens diaphragm forward, and it can shift the vitreous a little bit, as can reading and accommodating. Some glaucoma patients are very high risk for retinal detachment. For me, that's the patients with pigmentary glaucoma. They have something like a 10% retinal tear rate, you know, 25% lattice degeneration rate. These are high numbers. They're an at-risk population. And I do think if you give enough of those patients a miotic, some of the ones that already have tears will have a detachment. But the statement that a healthy eye without any retinal tears that takes a low concentration of pilocarpine is going to have a problem, I think, is inaccurate. And that's something I want to, you know, there's no literature for that. The best study of pilocarpine ever is actually the phase 3 Vuity studies. And so, you know, we have good data. No one had a retinal detachment in those studies. And it's safe from that standpoint. Examine the retina. If the retina is healthy, proceed. The other ones that you get into, things like cell and flare or PAS, you know, I'll just remind you that Pilo was initially used to keep the iris open in people who had angle closure in the years before laser iridotomy. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's how old pilocarpine is. And I think a lot of those eyes had PAS. Then they got the iridotomy. They had inflammation. They had chronic cell and flare. And Pilo just took the blame for all those things. I do not see PAS. I do not see cell and flare in patients, you know, in the modern era treated with pilocarpine. And we could say things like there were higher concentrations. It was QID. But really, I just don't think that, really we have to worry too much about those at any concentration. Now,
agreed 100%. So let me reply to those two. Because when the RD conversation first started, it occurred to me that that was never a thought of mine in the patients I was previously prescribed with pilocarpine. Yeah. And yet that is such a hot topic. And I understand people's consideration of a serious side effect, but I do also think that it's somewhat overblown. And I think that if the patient has a full, clear, fundoscopic evaluation, that there really is low to minimal risk, if any. Now, with the cell and flare or uveitis issue or iritis issue, you know, specifically, in the years in which we would refer for a patient who required a eventual laser PI, we were aware to try to remedy the anterior chamber the best that we could before instilling pilocarpine. But sometimes cell and flare is just really hard to see. And so it's quite plausible that there was some subclinical cell and flare present that then once the pilocarpine got instilled, it all of a sudden became a culprit, even though it was not a culprit at all.
Yeah, you know, we do sort of make associations, and you know, but again, we're with a different concentration, formulation, dosing, and different eyes. You got to give eyes that aren't in angle closure some credit here. And you know, most of the people we're prescribing this for have healthy anatomy, healthy eyes, aren't prone to other disease, and so it is a totally a totally different risk profile overall once you put it all together.
So you would say, generally speaking, a uveitis eye, a glaucoma eye, is a different eye than is a healthy eye.
Agreed. I'm trying to think, are there any of the other side effects that we need to talk about here with the traditional stigma of pilocarpine? One thing I'll make a comment is about narrow angles. And as I mentioned, we do use traditionally pilocarpine to keep the angles open. Now, there are all sorts of weird eyes on this planet, and there are a few eyes that'll narrow more with pilocarpine. Most open their angle with pilo, even most narrow angle eyes. That's why we have a warning on cough medicine, which of course is cycloplegic, does the opposite of pilo. Those are the ones that have the warning, don't take this if you have glaucoma, meaning narrow angles. So generally speaking, pilo isn't particularly risky for eyes with narrow angles. But I think you and I might agree that if there's a question, if someone has a narrow angle issue, first of all, they probably need a laser, but go ahead and take a pause on vuity in those eyes just to keep yourself out of any trouble. Or put a drop in, take a second look at the angle and know which way the pilocarpine or vuity turns that eye. And then you'll know if there's risk to taking it or not.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Honestly, the data that we got from the Gemini studies in terms of side effect profile is a really safe looking eye formulation. Headache was one thing that was purposefully investigated in depth, perhaps over so, but everything else is like we see in pretty much all topical ophthalmics. You know, very low incidence of hyperemia, you know, injection, et cetera. Some patients had a little bit of discomfort, but really minimal to none. So given that we knew that brow ache and headache was commonplace with historical pilocarpine use, that was pretty much targeted in the clinical trials. And something along the lines of 15% of the treatment arm experienced some headaches, whereas, 7%-ish or 8%-ish of the control arm experienced it with a placebo. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree that the safety profile overall just excellent in the study, and I agree, low headache. And I do think that Allergan found a way to get the formulation just right because, I think of pilocarpine as, it does what it does. And if you put too much in the eye, you're going to have headache. And, things like that. If you don't put enough, you won't get the efficacy. And I think they really found the sweet spot in this formulation of getting enough benefit to get enough people to have those three-line gains and, really make a difference in intermediate vision and all of these things. But if you overdo it with pilo, you're going to have the side effects. You're going to have the headache. Put some pilo 6% in and, everyone will have a headache at that concentration. So you have to get the formulation right. And I think they did. There may be stronger miotics in the future. I don't know if a weaker one is needed because this one is so well tolerated, but I think there's a sweet spot. And I think that they did that really well. And as you probably know, the one thing they didn't assess in the trial that they might have now, if they could go back, was dimming. And, dimming's a bizarre, thing, you're shrinking the pupil, so you're going to notice that, it's not a problem. It's probably one of those things that if you just say to your patient, hey, you may notice it's a little dimmer. That's how the drop works because it's shrinking your pupil. Don't worry about it. A patient will dismiss it right away. I warn patients about dimming. I'll warn them about distance blur, but not everyone. I tend to warn my younger patients about that, when I'm prescribing it. How about you? What do you tell your patients, to sort of expect or keep an eye out for at the moment of the prescription?
I'm glad you asked, Nate, because the style of prescribing this vuity drop has changed for me from middle December to today. And it was fairly swift and early on. And it was exactly what you said. It was not the side effect profile. It was not the headaches. It was not redness. It was some dimming of vision. And I started wondering, this issue didn't come out in the trials. But the Gemini trials were designed to dose the patients in the mornings and then evaluate them through a 10-hour day. So then I'm thinking, okay, well, we did these studies and we starting in the morning. So the sun's coming up, the patient's in a dark exam lane on and off, but the lights go on and off. And then when they take breaks, the sun's still out and they go home at the end of the day. But when I was dosing vuity as a sample in my chair, well, ECPs like to work in the dark, and so my exam lane's dark. And then when I was prescribing it in the pharmacy, a lot of patients go through their pharmacy drive through after work, or they pick it up midday and use it because they're excited after work at the end of the day. And that's when the sun's going down. So given that, I change immediately to, I really don't sample that much in office. And when I call it in, I ask my patients, listen, most of the issues that were identified in the trials were mild, but they were also transient. Patients tend to adapt to the medication over the course of a few days. So I want you to start, let's say tomorrow or on a weekend, but I want you to stick with it for 7 days, but only dose it in the mornings. Once you're through that 7-day course, you'll understand what the medication is going to offer you, quality of vision, quality of life wise. And then you can kind of pick and choose when you would like to use the medication, but do it in the mornings. And I feel a little bit, I'm getting more success now because patients aren't prematurely giving it a bad rap because of this dimming piece. And I think it's really only because the lights are on, the day, the sun's still out, and that's not exacerbating the this dimming phenomenon.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, you know, there are just some patients where it clicks at day three, mm-hmm. you know, and you are giving a patient also an opportunity to get past the headache. You know, I know that you'll never keep a headache forever associated with a miotic. They always go away at some point, whether it's after the first dose, the third dose, or what have you. It's you know, and again, the analogy I use with patients is, you know, the first time you lift something heavy at the gym, you're going to feel that muscle ache too, you know, and your eyes are working out like they haven't in a long time. So, you know, take a Tylenol if you need it, but it's not a bad, you know, thing. There's nothing wrong happening.
So there's another phenomenon that I've noticed in less patients, less than the dimming, and that, and I think my patients have a hard time articulating it. This is a very low incidence, but, and they describe it as some type of a jumping of vision or flickering of vision. And I've noticed it more in my older patients. It also is transient. It also goes away. And so it's not something that I'm worried about. I do say, hey, if this happens, just stick with it. You'll adapt to it. But in trying to figure out what exactly is going on, based on what you just said, maybe these older patients in particular who've had a kind of ciliary body that really hasn't been doing much in recent years. Now you're pharmacologically stimulating it, and maybe they're sensing something that they just haven't touched in a while.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think I know what you're talking about with that one. And, you know, there's probably also just some like upstream effects, like, you know, how your brain kind of is interpreting vision, you know, in a different sort of light settings and things like that. You know, how you detect motion and you know, different pathways. So who knows? But you know, what's amazing about it is, I think how well it works. Are you, do you use it differently in patients of different age, different sort of refractive statuses? I mean, you know, what are you finding there as you...
Honestly, my strategy is what you said first, is I'm trying to create a habit that I haven't had ever, which is trying to remember that a pharmacologic treatment for presbyopia exists. Yep. And even though the study was designed from ages 40 to 55, that to me does not mean that a 39-year-old couldn't take benefit from it, nor does it mean a 65-year-old couldn't take benefit from it. To me, it's all about giving patients a less dependence on their reading prescriptions, whatever form they may take, and potentially a better quality of life by able to use their eyes like they have when they were younger.
Yeah, absolutely. I am using it. You know, it's not really off-label. It's approved for anyone, but it was only studied in phakic patients, and I have been using it in some of my pseudophakes, particularly Vivity IOLs, to call them out, where, you know, you chose the Vivity because the patient didn't want halo, you knowing you wouldn't get all the reading in the world. And now you've got a chance to boost it. And, you know, I'll maybe give them the sample, text me if it's working. I love those texts. You know, it's the one time I'm happy to get a text from a patient. Hey, you know, I can read. I'm texting you without my glasses. And so that's been a nice little area for me to use it as well.
Any other IOL patients or pseudophakic patients, older generation IOLs, and patients who are maybe having challenges with other multifocal products, or is it just Vuity that comes to mind?
Yeah, you know, Vivity. Yeah, Vivity and Vuity. I know it's a tongue twister. I've tried it on somewhere. It didn't work, like a decentered multifocal IOL patient. It wasn't happier, which not a huge surprise there. But, you know, it's always worth giving the pinhole effect a chance to improve or exacerbate a situation, right?
Sure.
So I also will say there just are patients whose pupils, I'm one of them, and, you know, I use Vuity. And I've had PRK, so my cornea's optical zone isn't, you know, the normal optical zone. It's, and I have slightly larger pupils. I mean, you know, 5 millimeters. I'm just not, I don't have small pupils. But interestingly, Vuity improves my night vision. And, you know, that is just so against the teaching of the pinhole effect. And, you know, you and I know that in some people, constricting the pupil will compromise night vision. But if you have a cornea that's got a better central optical zone than peripheral, and you have big pupils at baseline that get bigger with, you know, scotopic viewing, you can actually get an improvement. And so I would just, to me, that sort of tells you everything you need to know, which is everyone's going to have a slightly different experience based on their optics, their age, their lens status, their pupil size, you know, their personality, their motivation. And this is a great tool that, you know, in my opinion, you should offer to a wide variety of patients. And then you and I will definitely be having a different conversation in a few years, you know, with many, many patients under our belt. But for right now, it's the time to kind of educate ourselves, educate our patients, let them know that they have these options. And just get some of these, you know, new treatments out to them.
Yep, 100%. You know, once I'm doing better with my habit of remembering, I try to bring it up to all my presbyopic patients, given that the safety profile is so positive that I really feel it's no harm, no foul. Let them experience it, because it could really deliver a benefit to quality of life, make people feel younger again, and boy, that's worth everything.
Yeah. You know, and I don't know if you've been to the dermatologist recently, but, you know, if I go to a dermatologist, I walk out of there with like 9 scripts. I mean, some of them, you know, we just had a brief conversation and, you know, I'm like, oh, wow, there's that cream for the back of my forearm, you know, and you know, the point is you just give the patient the option. I mean, half the time I don't pick them all up. Sometimes I do, you know, it depends on the situation. But the basically dermatologists have this great concept of putting the choice to fill a script in your hands, because all of their scripts are pretty much elective, right? We do some medical things. I don't consider glaucoma medication very elective. I mean, if I write it, I want you taking it. But you know, we can get into a mode with Vuity where we just prescribe it for a lot of our patients and just let them know, hey, there's something new for, you know, reading. I put it to your pharmacy, you know, talk to them, decide if you want it. And it's a different model, I think, than the rest of our drugs. I do that a little bit with some of the dry eye meds. Hey, I'm sending it in. You keep using it if you like it. Got to be a little careful with, you know, Restasis, which takes a few months, but
right.
I like putting things in the patient's hands and just providing the option for them.
I like it. Let's do that. Let's do that for everybody listening. Let's get Vuity in patients' hands and eyes and let them experience what it can deliver for themselves, but truly an exciting product. So any closing thoughts before we close the book on this one, Nate?
No, I share your enthusiasm, and I think, you know, it's time to get to know this option. And, you know, as you know, patients are asking for it now. The commercials are out there. I saw one on TV last night. And a surreal moment. You know, the patients are going to be coming for it. And I think you just want to make sure that you're in a position to offer it to them when they ask for it. Because it's really, it's bringing patients into doctor's office. It's doing a good thing there. And it's what they're asking for.
You got it. 128 million American presbyopes, and a quarter of them are trying to treat it themselves with reading glasses and aren't even coming into their ECP. So let's bring those folks in and take care of this monster of a mega group of patients in our world today.
Totally agree.
Thank you again, Nate, for being a guest on the podcast, and I look forward to bringing you on again in the future.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.